Okay, so Luke's introduction on the temple is actually related to Job, and in quite a significant way, because the refrain in the temple is that God is good and his hesed, his covenantal love, endures forever. And the issue in Job, or one of the issues, is the question, is God really good? And kind of, in fact, the problem of suffering and evil is kind of one of those topics that non-Christians often use as a you know, the knockdown argument for atheism. So David Hume, who was an atheist philosopher, said that you can't have a God who is both all-powerful and all-loving. So just look at the world. If God is really all-powerful, then surely all the suffering and the evil in life shows you that he's not really loving. Or if God is really loving, then surely the suffering and evil in the world shows you that he's not all-powerful. But you can't have it both ways. And that was kind of, he said, so just look at life. You've got this nice theological construction that just doesn't map up to real life. But actually, rather than being a knockdown argument that God doesn't exist, kind of Job takes us more into, actually, it's often our own experience of suffering and evil is actually often a doorway into God's presence and into kind of the deeper mysteries of God. In fact, last year I went to this a meeting in Portland. Group of NAVs got together to pray, and the guy who was leading it, a guy called Lee Brace, and he used to lead the work in the Netherlands, I think. And he just talked about how he came back from the Netherlands, and it wasn't a great success. And there was like this 18-month period where God just wasn't there. Prayed, had his quiet time, whatever, but just God was not there. And he talked about this long period of darkness. And then he finished speaking, and then someone else said, oh, in my period of darkness. And then they went into their period where God just seemed not to be there for about 5 years. And it kind of, and then this kicked off a chain reaction around the room of almost everyone in the room talking about their long and difficult kind of period of darkness. And it was almost like this was a necessary phase that God takes us through to kind of encounter him more fully. So it's been said, and I think kind of as you come into Job, you get the same sense of that. So as I was just reading through Job's speeches, you know, that interchange between Job and his counselors, you'll notice that most of the Job's talk is directed not at his friends, but it's directed at God. And so all the way through, even in the midst of hardship and toil, Job never loses sight that the basic issue is God. The issue is not suffering and evil, the issue is God. And that's, you know, that's enough. And so, and as I thought about Job, it's been said that there are, as you go through life, as you kind of move kind of from 20s into 30s into 40s, somewhere in there, kind of four key transitions happen. And they are, really quickly, the transition from doing to being, so that our sense of identity moves from what we achieve and what we produce and what we attain, more into just who we are in Christ. Kind of our identity is rooted in who God says we are. And so kind of affirmation, recognition, success come to mean a lot less. And our identity is, so that transition from doing stuff to just being. The second is a transition from complexity to simplicity. Okay, so I think, you know, any fool can make something complicated, but it takes a genius to make it simple. And the same is true in the spiritual life. There was an American High Court judge called Oliver Wendell Holmes, who came up with lots of really nice pithy quotes. And one of them was something like, I'm trying to remember it now, I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I'd give my all for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. So there's kind of, you go through, so there's kind of a black and white, you know, this is the way it is phase, and then you kind of hit a, well, wait a minute, that doesn't quite work phase. So what's going on here phase? And then you kind of come out of that with a kind of a crystallized, actually, this is what's going on. The simplicity on the other side of complexity. And in many ways, this is the journey that Job goes on through the book of Job, is that the journey from complexity to simplicity. But it's also a journey from the third transition, from certainty to mystery. And we'll talk about that quite a lot. And then the fourth transition from taking to giving. So these kind of four transitions, from doing to being, from complexity to simplicity, from certainty to mystery, and from taking to giving. And all of these are kind of markers of spiritual growth or progress towards Christ-likeness. All of them are kind of outworkings of biblical hope. And all of them are evident to some degree in the story of Job. So it's just kind of... So let's just talk about Job. Has everyone kind of read Job this morning, cover to cover? No, okay. Yeah, okay. Has everyone kind of read Job at some point in the history?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Right. Okay, so so Job then, so we'll just do the make sure we're on the same page real quick. But so Job's one of the oldest stories in the Bible. So Job he's not Jewish, he's from the land of Uz, so that's kind of Arab Peninsula somewhere. Probably lived around the time of Abraham or a bit before, so he's kind of patriarchs or thereabouts. So he's an example of God speaking into a pagan culture, much like he spoke into the life of Abraham. But the book itself appears to be written much later, so maybe written about 1000 BC, kind of sometime after Solomon, another link with this morning's thing, between Solomon and the exile. And Job forms part of the wisdom literature of the Bible, along with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Song. And the great thing about wisdom literature is that it makes you think, and it doesn't give you all the answers on a plate. Okay? So as you go through wisdom literature, sometimes it tells you what's right, and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it gives you this kind of half-half kind of mix. So it's, what language was that? Swahili, yeah, sorry. 50-50 mix. Okay. So for example, if you look at, just real quick, Ecclesiastes 4, verse 1. Can someone read just 4, 1 to 3? This is... to get us into wisdom literature. Ecclesiastes 4, 1 to 3. Yep.
Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power is on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not yet seen the evil that is done under the sun.
Okay, right. Now,
better not to have been born.
Yeah, so basically kind of the writer of Ecclesiastes, he kind of sides with Job and says that you look around at just the pain in life and basically there's no answer, and it's better just... Now, is that something that we're to embrace, or is that a view that we're supposed to shun, or is it kind of somewhere in the middle? In the Bible, right? So if you turn over to Matthew 9, 35 to 38, you have a very similar scene and a slightly different perspective on the same scene. Matthew 9, 35 to 38.
Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field."
Okay, so basically, Jesus and Solomon kind of seeing the same scene, you know, seeing people as harassed and helpless, depressed and pain, but they have very different perspectives. So Jesus says there's an answer. It's not a quick fix answer. The answer is in a certain quality of person, laborers for the harvest field. But there is hope, and the hope is by becoming certain kinds of people, we engage with God and his purposes, and we begin to bring in kind of the kind of transformation God sees. Solomon says, it's just too tough. just give up. So wisdom literature kind of puts these viewpoints out for us. It doesn't tell us at the time this is right or this is wrong. You're supposed to sit there and muse on it. Okay, and kind of let it percolate in your soul. And this is what the book of Job is supposed to do for us as well. So we know the story of Job. Job is wealthy, he's comfortable, and he's very religious. He's God-fearing. He regularly does make sacrifices every time he has a party or his kids have a party. He has a whole lot of sacrifices in case they just went a little bit too far. And then one day, the angels appear before God. Job doesn't know about this, of course. And then this little discussion between God and Satan happens, and then a bet is made between God and Satan, whether if Job suffers, you know, so basically the accusation is Job's only loyal because he's got it easy, you've put cotton wool around him, give him a taste of, you know, just let me at him for a few days and he'll change his mind. Okay, and so there's a bet between God and Satan that if Job is suffers, then he'll curse God. And so so Job's kind of oblivious to that discussion. All he knows is that somewhere out of nowhere, his world goes to pieces. Okay, so he's just going along, and then wham, on the same day, all his flocks, his herds, his camels, his ox, his sheep, they're all stolen. His shepherd, his cow herds, his camel herds are all killed. Then a freak storm, all his kids are killed. And then a little bit later, his health goes, and he's covered in painful sores. So it's basically like, yeah, someone's just pulled the carpet out from under his feet, and he's been whacked from multiple fronts. And then there seems to be no relief to his pain on either the inside or the outside. And So everyone would get to read 1 and 2, chapters 1 and 2. Okay, so who is responsible for Job's suffering? Okay, three choices. It's Job, it's God, or it's Satan. Okay. So who is responsible for Job's suffering? How many people think Job is responsible for his suffering? Oh, okay, how many people think Satan is responsible?
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. Okay. Yeah. How many people think God?
It's okay. Like a tag team effort, right? Which is the thing that's so concerning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there's
the permissiveness of God. Yeah. And there's that whole kind of.
In the world, there was never been suffering in the beginning.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So again, it's not a drop dead easy answer. Job 2:3. God says to Satan, "Though you caused me to destroy him without reason." So although there's that kind of tag team thing going on, God takes responsibility. So Satan's the agent, and there's certainly some interchange going on here. But God has picked the fight. So Satan turns up, and God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" So actually, God picks the fight. Satan then comes back with this idea. So you get this kind of, you know, this interaction going on. But then in 2:3, God seems to take responsibility for the suffering. And, you know, so There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without reason. So as you go through the book, Job kind of undergoes spiritual vertigo. He doesn't kind of know up from down. He kind of goes around in circles a lot. He's not quite sure what's going on. But the one thing he's got a hold of is that his problems with God. So, you know, if only, you know, his constant refrain is, if only I could get with God and get him to listen to me, we could get this sorted out. if only God hadn't turned his back against me. So having kind of lived in Africa for a while, where people are really kind of, can you live in this world where everyone's aware of evil spirits and witchcraft and, you know, blah, 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 you name it. And kind of often Satan gets a lot more credit than he's due. Okay, so people go around and kind of, you know, so Satan's powerful, yeah. But he's limited. He has to come via God's throne for permission. And so kind of the thing I like about Job is that all through this, you know, the real issue is not evil. The real issue is not suffering. The real issue is God. And so it's kind of Job's heart for God that's at stake here. In fact, so you kind of, the staged issue, if you look at, so when I look at biblical narratives, one of the tools I really like is kind of discourse analysis, which is kind of when you look at a story, there's always a staged issue. So a bit like when you read an Agatha Christie novel, right? There's a murder and the question is who done it, and then that gets resolved at the peak of the novel, at the climax. And so if you look at kind of a biblical narrative through that lens, and you ask, what is the issue in Job? What's the issue that the book's about? The issue is not about why is there suffering. Okay, and actually the book doesn't answer that. The staged issue in Job is, when Job suffers, will he curse God? That's the issue. And so it comes up a couple of times, but it's most powerfully put on the lips of Job's wife. You know, just curse God and die. Why don't you just curse God and die? And so the idea there of cursing God is not just, you know, giving him a verbal beating. The idea is kind of turning your back on God once for all. That's the idea there. And so kind of, it's almost like, you know, as you go through life, we're engaged in a spiritual battle. And Satan, you know, he's kind of, you know, we all know there's temptation there. Okay? So actually Satan's ambition is not just to get you to sin. You know, we know sin separates you from God and sin leads to death. But that's not really his aim. That's kind of phase one. So, you know, his first phase, Satan is a roaring lion. If he's trying to get you to sin, or he's trying to wound you somehow, some kind of injury, heart injury. And then kind of stage two is kind of that you then get ensnared or entrapped. Maybe that's kind of some habit that begins to have power over you, and then you begin to know that you can never escape from it. Or you have some kind of heart wound that you know can never get fixed. And you end up with this kind of head-heart schism where your head says, God is powerful, but your reality says, this area of my life can't be touched. Okay? And that's kind of phase two. But that's really not his aim either. His aim is to get you to curse God and die. I turn your back on God altogether and walk away from it and say, this is hopeless. That's actually, but, you know, he doesn't go straight for the jugular. He kind of leads you down this path. And so kind of that's, so we talked a little bit about these under the waterline issues when we did Joseph. The same themes there as well. So when as you go through Job, you get to the end. Job has a lot of rants against Job, against God. He's got a lot of angst. He's got a lot of confusion. He's got a lot of anger. And yet, you get to the end of the book, And God's okay with that. I mean, now there's a few things that Job needs to repent of. But basically, you get to the end of the book, and God says, Job spoke about me what was right, and these other friends didn't. So God can handle our ranting. It's okay to vent. Okay? So God isn't really that concerned about having nice, polite language in his presence. He's not concerned about you getting all the theological terms nice, or praying in that nice stained glass voice. He's much more after a kind of an earthy honesty in the interaction. And so James talks about, you know, we've heard about Job's perseverance. It doesn't say about Job's perfection. He talks about that Job persevered, that all through that he knew that the issue was God. And that's what he hung on to. So as we go through the book, kind of the issue is, when Job suffers, will he turn his back on God once and for all? That's the issue. And as we go through the book, kind of Job's suffering is not lifted. He does, we could go through these wonderful rants that he has at God. I mean, they're just brilliant. There's some wonderful. Job 10, 15 to 19, it's fairly close to cursing. someone wants to read that. There's numbers of them. I mean, it's just great. Job 10, 15 to 19. Can I read that? Yeah. Go on. Yeah, go on.
Somebody else right there. Rant. I am guilty, woe to me. Even if I'm innocent, I cannot lift my head. For if I am full of shame and drown in my affliction, if I hold my head high, you stalk me like a lion, and again display your awesome power against me. 19. You bring new witnesses against me, and increase your anger towards me. Your waves come against me, wave upon wave. Sorry, your forces come against me, wave upon wave. Why did you bring me out of the womb? I wish I'd died before any eyes saw me. If only I had never come into being or been carried straight from the womb to the grave.
So he's saying, look, if I'm guilty, doesn't matter. If I'm innocent, it doesn't matter. You're still going to wallop me. Right? You know, this is just so unjust. And you just kind of get that sense of, there's nowhere I can take this. You know, there's nowhere I can take this injustice, because actually my problem's with you. And there's no higher court of appeal, and it doesn't matter what I do, you're just going to squash me. And so Job 19, 10 and 11. Anyone want to put Job 19, 10 and 11 on their own list?
He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And my hope has he has pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath against me, and he counts me as the first.
Right. So instead of being the God of hope, he's the God who's taken away my hope. And he's, you know, not, you know, God is for us, Romans 8, but this God is against me. And he kind of, that's kind of the vertigo. He doesn't know up from down. He doesn't know if God's, you know. So this is not quite cursing God, because he hasn't turned his back on God. He's actually talking to God in the midst of this. Okay. So the fact that he's engaging with God tells you that he hasn't given up on God. And this is really great, because although, you know, kind of, I think what, as you go through, the issue is not how good Job's faith is. The issue is that God doesn't give up on Job. And of course you get that in the New Testament. You know, so in Galatians, Paul says, now that you know God, or rather that God has known you. And it's that sense of you're in God. It's not that you're holding on to God. It's that sense that you're in God's hand. You know, that God's knowing you is the key thing for security. Not how brilliant the Christian life is. That's the key thing for security. So, you know, God can handle Job's questions. He can handle Job's rants. It's really not about Job getting everything right. And so as you go through Job, actually going through those ramps is actually quite an important part of going through that transition from certainty to mystery. So I was telling something about when we came back to the UK a few years ago, and Annie was going back into the GP world, and it was so hard. I mean, so how long ago did you actually get the letter saying you ticked off back in? A couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
The final confirmation. What should be a 2-year process has taken 5 years because there's just this broken system. And I remember
there was
just
no system.
There was no system.
It's starting to happen. Now.
It's starting to happen. And and so basically she'd be going through this and being caned by the various authorities because she didn't tick the boxes which were impossible to tick. You know. And it's like, God, this is so unfair, you know. And I remember kind of ranting to God, God, what do you know about unjust suffering? But it's almost like you had to voice that out because it was so tough. But actually, God can handle that. And so as we kind of go through this, God can really deal with the rants. And in fact, he wants them. A really key part of kind of moving towards maturity. So so if you go through Job, kind of a lot of people think that one of the other reasons that Job was written, so if you've got that stage question, where there was kind of a lot of kind of contemporary theology about why suffering happens, and same stuff is still around today. You can find it in all those Christian self-help books. Which on one level sounds really good, but on another level is so fundamentally flawed it's going to do you more harm than good. Okay, and so basically each of the counselors kind of represent a different strand of false teaching, but it's kind of phrased in a very, you know, as you read through it, the counselors are so much more eloquent than Job. So they've got this eloquent, theologically sounding, you know, thing sorted, but it's actually rubbish, what they're saying. And so Eliphaz is the first one. So the first thing that the counselors do is they just sit and they say nothing, and that's brilliant. But as soon as they open their mouth, they kind of do more harm than good. So and so you get to the end of Job, and God says, you know, that these three counselors have not spoken right about God. So often when you see people quoting Job, taking a nice little verse out of context, just check who's speaking before you kind of sign up to it. So Eliphaz is, he starts in chapter 4 and he says something like this, verse 4, 6 and 7. Should not your piety be your confidence and your blameless ways your hope? Consider now who being innocent has ever perished, where were the upright ever destroyed? Right, so his basic thing is, Job, just be obedient, have a victorious Christian life, and everything will be okay for you. Right? Just, you know, just walk in the Spirit, and it'll all be fine. And the other two say something similar as well, but it's just not true. There is just not a one-to-one correlation between obedience and things going well. And in fact, if you go to the New Testament, obedience is more likely to get you suffering and persecution than it is to get you a BMW and a big house. Okay. So, but so they all have this different, the same message that just live right and life will be right. And it's fundamentally flawed, but they also have a different kind of angle with it. So Eliphaz is a bit of a mystic. He's kind of saying, well, actually the secret, Job, is you just need to be a bit more spiritual. You know, you just need, it's Job 4:12, he says, a word was secretly brought to me, my ears caught a whisper of it, amid disquieting dreams in the night, where deep sleep falls on men, fear and trembling seized me and made all my bones shake, a spirit glided past my face. You know, and so kind of had this vision, Job, and because I've got these super spiritual visions, I've got the skinny on you. I've got the inside track. So if you were just a bit more spiritual, Job, you know, you'd be okay. You know, you'd be like me. And then Bildad, comes along, says the same thing, but his answer is you need to be, you know, just, you need some old-timey religion, Job. You need to look back to your forefathers and, you know, and learn from their ways. And the answer's all in the traditions of the past. You know, if you just had a bit more, you know, read the Puritans, Job, you know. look to those old-timey guys. They had the answer. And just look backwards and be a bit more traditional, you know, and stop being so rebellious. And then Zophar, he's got the same thing, but that his thing is wisdom. You know, so Job 11:4. You say to God, my beliefs are flawless and I'm pure in sight. Oh, how I wish God would speak, that he would soon open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom. For true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sins. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? So Zophar's answer is, well, you need to, you know, you need wisdom. And so you have kind of super spiritual, supernatural experiences, tradition, and wisdom. Now you think, well, each of those is good. I mean, you'd be in trouble if you didn't kind of have some kind of spiritual experience. We'd be in trouble if our forefathers knew nothing about God, because that would mean we're all in the dark and there's no hope for anything. And this is, you know, wisdom's better than ignorance. So, you know, all those things have got something to them. But actually none of them is sufficient in themselves. And even none of them are sufficient put together. Because the real deal is you need to go, it's this idea of God and the mysteries of God. And so, particularly this transition from being certain into kind of, actually this stuff that I just can't get my head around, and that's okay, is really important. So at the beginning, you know, Job has a very mechanical faith. You know, he says, all I need to do, I fear God, I shun evil, I've got a nice moral code, if my children sin, I make a sacrifice, and it's all good. Nice kind of black and white, religious code, live well, everything will be okay, and guess what? It doesn't work. Okay? So that's kind of the simplistic, rule-oriented, mechanical faith. and then in Job, so basically each of these guys has a speech, Job responds, they have another cycle of speech and response, where basically Job silences their arguments. And then you hit this fourth counselor, Elihu, who's a kind of a bridge. He's not as stupid as the other three counselors. He's got a bit more insight, but he's still not quite there. So with Elihu's speech, what do I do with this? Some of this is right. But he's still basically saying Job's sinning, and that's why he's suffering. So it's kind of he's kind of moving in the right direction, but he's not quite there yet. And he's kind of a, and so this is wisdom literature, isn't it? So Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they're kind of anti-wisdom, where kind of they're kind of putting, they're eloquent, but it's what you're not supposed to believe. And then Elihu is, well, he's more kind of a mixture of some good stuff and some wrong stuff. And you have to sit and let it percolate in your soul a bit to discern what's worth taking and what needs to be thrown out. But I think that's the path that God takes us on. If he doesn't give us black and white answers, he doesn't sit you down and say, well, this is it, bang, 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 bang. He actually wants the much more relational faith, where you've actually got to sit with him and discuss stuff and pore over it and go back over it and go back to him time and time again. And that, so as you go on this transition from certainty to mystery, it's not that you lose all certainty, but you end up with a different type of certainty. You end up not with a nice theological, I've got all my boxes ticked certainty. You end up with a relational certainty, where the certainty is based in the character and the nature and your relationship with God, rather than having all the intellectual answers. Does that make sense? It's a certainty, but it's a different type of certainty. It's a certainty that's quite happy to not know. to not know how it all hangs together. So we're talking with someone about kind of different theological groupings in the West or in the UK or the US or wherever. And there's certainly a whole camp, and I think our church in the UK is part of it, which doesn't like mystery. And so it kind of pushes into trying to dot every I and cross every T theologically. And in some ways, and so kind of when you get that thing, it becomes very hard and ungracious sometimes. But it also means that people who are pushing into mystery, people often look at that and I say, oh, you're backsliding. You know, you're falling away from your faith, but actually they're going into a deeper faith that having a nice box-down theology doesn't let you get to. So that's a little bit of a scary transition, because you have to, you know, you have to throw away, or not, I'll put that more gently, you don't have to throw it away, but you have to reevaluate a lot of the things that you thought you were certain of. And so as you go through that, you know, early in your Christian life, some things are black and white, some things are grey. As you go on, a lot of those things that you thought were black and white suddenly become a lot less black and white, maybe more grey. And some of those things that you thought were grey resolve into, actually, no, that's not good and that is good, or, you know, they become a lot more clarified. And so there's kind of a...
You might want to give an example there. No, I was just thinking,
okay.
So for instance, relational integrity, or actually relationship, take on a much higher priority than...
Okay, I'll give you some simple examples. Okay, so bribery and corruption, right? Is it ever right to give a bribe? Yes or no? Come on, you Christians. Is it ever right to give a bribe?
No. Yes.
No, okay, so that's the black and white answer. So, I'm traveling with my wife on a truck across the African desert. And actually with another girl,
Leah.
Leah. Okay, and we get stopped at this army checkpoint in the middle of the desert. It's just coming up to dusk, it's getting late. There's a Muslim army captain who's absolutely high on drugs.
She's called Amina.
Which means faith in Arabic. Actually high on drugs, who, been chewing amphetamines all day. And so she takes Annie and Leah hostage and demands a ransom for their release.
And says they've got false passports.
And blah, blah. So, okay, so what do? Do you just sit it out? Do you pay something? What do?
Is this bribery?
Is that bribery? So I remember at the time thinking, oh, I don't want to pay a bribe. And then, so kind of having that whole restaurant, actually, so it's maybe a little, I don't know about this. So anyway, it was a dollar. That was the bribe. So I paid the dollar, and we went going. And then Leah was this other girl. She was so mad at me. So she was happy to stay there and be thrown in prison for the next 6 months. And you know,
so we have to go to the local police station
for this
person.
We were in the middle.
The world,
yeah. So basically, I take that more as extortion rather than bribery. And then you look actually in the scriptures, and it's a little bit more nuanced. Actually, so if you look at Proverbs, there's lots of proverbs about bribery, but it's all about the person that receives the bribe, not the person who's extorted. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's, you know, there's more going on. So that would be maybe one example where the ethic becomes, it's a little bit more complicated than just never do that. Is it right to cheat on your taxes? I'd still say that's probably not a good thing. Okay. but it's, you know, we live in a world which is a little bit more complicated. Or maybe when I was younger, you know, growing up as... Before I was a Christian, you know, in our house we watched an awful lot of TV, you know, so my parents would watch Coronation Street every night and things like that. And so kind of, well, what's wrong with just sitting around and watching TV? You know, is it really such a bad thing? And the, you know, well, there's nothing in the Bible about that, you know. But as you go on, you think, actually, life's really short. And actually, it is a moral issue, because every hour I spend doing that is an hour I'm not really engaging in something more significant. So that's an issue for me that used to be a bit more grey and didn't really matter. And then that resolves into actually a more significant issue. So that's kind of, does that make sense? Those sort of things, yeah. So then you get into this. So what I'm saying with wisdom, it doesn't give you the answer on a plate. And so when you get to the kind of the peak of Job, which is when God speaks to Job, how does God answer Job's questions about all the unjust stuff he's had? How does God answer Job? Yeah, he doesn't explain to him chapters 1 and 2, really. He just says, Job, we just sang it, an indescribable. You know, do you know where the snow is kept? Do you know how to make mountain goats, Job? Did you invent stars, Job? You know, so, yeah. So he kind of overpowers him with kind of the awesome kind of mystery. And then he kind of goes on, do you know how the mind works, Job? You know, so not just the physical, but look, Job, I guess what? I made your mind and I gave you the ability to even think those thoughts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ooh, okay. So it gets horribly self-referential in there as well, you know, kind of. And he begins to overpower him. But however, in that, so there's some wonderful stuff just to meditate on. But there's also some stuff in there that as I read it is there's some really fascinating imagery that we might not just pick up the first time. So one of them is he talks about, Job, do you set boundaries for the sea? Now, so you're kind of aware that in Hebrew literature, the sea is not just a physical picture of the sea. Okay, it's a metaphor for chaos. And so the Israelites were not great sailors. They didn't have navies. They maybe fished a bit on the Sea of Galilee, but even come from the New Testament, they hated the ocean as soon as there was a storm. They were crying like babies. They were not great sailors. And so kind of the sea is a kind of a picture of chaos and evil. And one of the things God says to Job is, do you set a boundary for the sea? He's not just talking about the ocean. He's talking about, I set a boundary for chaos and evil. Okay, so, and so like when you get to Revelation, you know, one of the pictures of the new heaven and new earth is that there will be no more sea. It's not saying there's no more beach. Okay, it's saying there's no more chaos and evil. Okay, and then so kind of once you kind of get that sea theme, it comes up all the way through Job and other places. But the other thing is he talks about Behemoth and Leviathan. Did you come across those? And so you know, and so well, what do you make of that? Well, on one level, you can kind of read Behemoth and think hippopotamus. So is God just saying, you know, I'm stronger than a hippopotamus? Well, he could be saying that, but it seems to be quite a weak point compared to I made stars and mountains, and then you read Leviathan, and you could kind of read it like a crocodile, except the crocodile ends up kind of breathing fire and sounds more like a dragon, you know. And so it's probably not just a crocodile. And so kind of, again, what you get in this ancient literature is that kind of concepts like evil and death and Satan are often kind of pictured as mythical creatures, mythological creatures, and that's what's probably going on here. So Behemoth was probably a mythological picture for death, so much like we'd have the Grim Reaper, you know, and it maybe, so maybe instead of thinking hippopotamus, think Grim Reaper as you read through the Behemoth, you know, he just, you know, I just let them wallow, you know, sit in the marsh and enjoy the sunshine and, you know, kind of, I put death kind of a territory and some boundaries. And then Leviathan is kind of this picture for Satan himself. So that's why you get, you know, in Revelation it's the same imagery. Or in Job 3:8 he says, may those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. That's Job speaking in Job 3:8. So he's not talking about rousing the crocodile. He's talking about, you know, that if you're going to curse days, and that idea of rousing the Leviathan is to call on Satan to come and do his stuff. It's kind of like invoking the devil, is what he's talking about. And, you know, it's calling on the arch enemy of God to come and attack God's creation. So when God, when you come to that, you know, this is what I do for Leviathan, would you put Leviathan on a lead and give him to your daughter to play with? He's not saying, would you give her a pet crocodile? He's saying, would you give Satan to your daughter as a pet? And she would, you know, of course you wouldn't, you know, but he's my pet. I lead him around on a lead, basically. And he can only do, as fierce and vicious as he is, he can only do what I let him do. And so although he doesn't explain Job 1 and 2 to Job explicitly, he kind of gives him some picture language that would kind of let him kind of muse on it a bit. So so what God is really saying there in 38 and 39 is kind of the physical universe, but then when he talks about Behemoth and Leviathan, he's talking about kind of the spiritual universe and how God kind of controls that. So I guess the big question of Job, though, so as you go through, is the thing that Job couldn't deal with was not the physical suffering. That was hard. It was God's silence through all of it. So why does God wait all that time before he speaks in? So if you've ever been through times of waiting and hardship and suffering, it's often kind of the silence of God that is the hardest thing to deal with. So I think it was Francis of Assisi basically felt God was silent for the last few years of his life. Just, you know, so this idea that if you're spiritual, God will always speak to you and you'll have this close, intimate relationship and it will be wonderful all the time. Not true. God will take you, as we said before, you know, take you into the desert that he might talk quietly to you. So, you know, if God just gives simple black and white answers where everything is certain, everything is cut and dry, you'll boil down God to a mechanical kind of do list. Just kind of, you'll have the kind of faith that Job had in chapter 1. But when you get to Job later on, he's got a very different faith. You know, he talked about my eyes have seen. And he doesn't do... You get to the end, he's kind of in a very different place. You don't see him doing all those rituals and all that kind of stuff. He's kind of been freed from that. And he's freed into a much kind of mature, hope-filled relationship with God at the end. So, in fact, one of the things he says in this journey is in Job 26:14, he's talking about all the fantastic stuff of God, and then he says that these are only the outer fringe of his ways. And it's just like, we've just begun to get a glimpse of what God's like. It's a bit like in Isaiah, where, you know, Isaiah sees God in the temple, and he says he saw the train of his robe. Now, I used to think that was like a wedding gown, you know, it just went on forever and ever and ever. It's not what it's talking about. Israeli kings didn't have wedding gowns. They had kind of quite simple stuff. And kind of the word there really means the hem. So he's looking at the lower centimeter or so of God's garment, you know, the bit that just covers his ankle. And that's the bit that he's glimpsed. And he hasn't kind of seen the rest yet. So it's kind of, again, that's picture language. But I guess Job kind of raises questions about what can we expect from life. You know, we not to expect it to be smooth, because kind of Job suffers not because he did wrong, but because he was walking with God or trying to walk with God. And actually God picked the fight. And so his suffering wasn't just the suffering of living in an unfair world. His suffering was because he was in a battle between God and Satan. But more than that, Job wasn't just in a battle. Job was the battle. He was the battlefield. And so kind of, you know, Jesus would say in the Gospels, you know, the kingdom is within you. But guess what? So is the battle. You know, the real battle in the Christian life is what's going on in your heart. And that's where the battlefield is. And so often kind of so much about the Christian life is the battle for our hearts and what's going on in our hearts. And this is again with that area of what God is doing in our heart and what's going on in our heart is really key. So, you know, lots of heart words in Scripture. You know, if you're full on for God, you're wholehearted, right? But there's lots of broken-hearted, hard-hearted, you know, kind of not quite wholehearted pictures. And so what God's after is wholehearted. And I think that transition, just a little bit more on that transition from certainty to mystery, because it's a real key one. One of my favorite books is, so I'd recommend you have a good read of, is a book called Churchless Faith by a guy called Alan Jamieson. So he was a New Zealander, which is partly why I like the book. But he was a pastor, and he noticed that a lot of people between age 35 and 45 had been really key in his church. Just walked away from the Christian life, walked away from his church. And so he went on this quest as to why. And he said, okay, so if you ask the pastors, and he did a study of about 200 different churches, okay, if you ask the pastors, they would say all those people were 98% were backsliders. If you ask the people themselves, 2% said they were backsliders, and the other 98% said they were just Christians, but church didn't do it for them anymore. And so he's got this whole thing about what a churchless faith looks like. And in many ways, it's this journey from certainty into mystery. So it's a really interesting read. But it talks about, it's on that journey where you're moving out of safety and security and just letting the Christian community around you dictate what's okay. And you have to kind of move, like Job, into quite a lonely place where you might be quite misunderstood. Again, so Job's counselors are looking at him and saying that he's backsliding and sinning. And a lot of people on this journey, that's how they're perceived by good, upright Christians. But actually they're moving kind of into a deeper level of faith. And the real challenge there is to find other people who are on that journey with you. Because often it's a very lonely and misunderstood place. But it's actually, I think, to kind of get to a place of spirituality that offers hope to the 95% of Brits who will never go near a church, it's really, really key. Because it's reality that's borne out kind of in the midst of life. So so just to say kind of that mystery of not needing to know, of not having all your theology nicely tied down anymore, is not an intellectual or spiritual laziness. It's actually part of embracing what God's really like. Okay, so there's hope there, but there's certainty, but it's a different sort of certainty. I think that's the journey of Job in many respects. So I'll stop there.